So why don't we get started? I'm Alex Dagan. I'm CEO of ConservationX Labs, which is a conservation technology company focused on harnessing exponential technologies, open innovation, and entrepreneurship to address conservation's wicked problems. I was formerly chief scientist at USAID, where we had set up the Global Development Lab, which used grand challenges and many of these tools to address these problems. I want to make a couple of points before I introduce our panel. We have actually an amazing panel, and this panel hasn't necessarily come from conservation or invasive species, but they've done incredible things on innovation. And part of it is how do we actually translate the very problems that we saw laid out in the previous panel and use innovation to rethink how we solve those solutions. And I think the first thing is just recognizing, I mean, it's clear, right? These challenges seem insurmountably hard, but we have incredible new tools and approaches, and we've already solved other big problems, right? We've eliminated, as you know, smallpox, an entire disease off the face of this planet. We eliminated rinderpest, which is a disease of livestock. We're about to eliminate polio. We're down to just a few cases in Nigeria and Afghanistan, and guinea worm, off the core, an entire species, an entire pathogen off the face of this planet. So the fact is these challenges aren't insurmountable. We have put a Volkswagen-sized rover on the surface of Mars, which is kind of crazy, using a sky crane on another planet. And we have amazing advances in science and technology, including in data, in AI, in robotics, in machine vision, in drones and nanosatellites and sensors and genetics. And we've seen an amazing democratization of what has happened in terms of the accessibility of those tools, plus the ability of increases in our connectivity, increases that have allowed us to harness new tools such as citizen science. We have the ability to understand behavior and behavioral innovations and economic innovations, to really understand marketing and entrepreneurship and bring those tools into what we're trying to do in conservation. And the tools and the technologies are actually already out there, but just haven't really been applied and scaled in ways that we want to see. I think the second is just recognizing that there's an incredible potential through open innovation. Joy's law, right, is the principle that no matter who you are, most of the smartest people work for someone else. And this is really, and he was the co-founder of Sun Microsystems, who was looking at Bill Gates, who was trying to capitalize on having all the smartest people. And he just pointed out it wasn't possible. So how do we actually use open innovation to leverage the tools that exist within agencies, to leverage new solvers and new solutions into what we're trying to do? Prizes and challenges, mass collaboration within, as part of our toolkit for addressing these really big problems. And both Wendy and Chris are going to be speaking about that today. I think it's clear that the solutions are multidisciplinary. We're now in a period where the experts don't own the entire problem. They can actually help define the problem, but they don't own the full sets of solutions that are out there. And this requires multidisciplinarity. It requires us to move beyond disciplines to a problem-oriented framework. It requires us to move beyond sort of a pure scientific descriptive approach to one that is more akin to engineering within what we're trying to do. And that means harnessing tools of co-creation and collaboration. And Wendy, I think, will have a chance to talk about this in terms of how she dealt with Zika and Ebola. And we need to work at scale. Pilots are really nice. It's really nice to electrify the single lionfish at one time. But when you have the fecundity of a single species as you do with lionfish, I think it is clear that we've got to think of scale from the beginning and build entire ecosystems and markets around what we're trying to do. And we've got amazing people in Nagesh and Lydia to be able to speak about this. I'm gonna just take a second to introduce our panel, and then what we will do is allow them to make a few remarks and then get involved into a discussion, because I think we should have, particularly right before dinner when most people have not had a bathroom break, or before lunch, when most people haven't had a bathroom break, a chance to have a vibrant engage. Wendy Taylor is the director for the Center for Accelerating Innovation and Impact. This is USAID's Global Health Innovation Center. She is one of the most creative persons I had the pleasure of working with at USAID. Lydia McClure is program director for NSF's ICOR, which is how do we actually train and translate our scientists and engineers to become innovators and apply those solutions in novel ways and bring them to scale. And she's at the National Science Foundation, and previously was at University of Texas's Austin's IC Squared Institute. Chris Nelson is the Assistant Director for Open Innovation, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and oversees much of our approaches toward prizes and challenges. Nagesh Rao is the Chief Technologist and Geek in Residence at the Small Business Administration, and another one of the great creatives that I've had the pleasure of working with in government. So I'm gonna pose to the group, and we'll start with Nagesh and move down the panel. These challenges seem unsurmountably hard. How can innovation help, and what have you learned listening to kind of the sets of challenges that we have from your own experience?
Thanks, Alex, and thank you everyone for welcoming me here today. Let's be real, we're on a planet with finite resources, but we're in an infinite universe. And so what we really need to start thinking about with our infinite brain power and that notion of going beyond is how do we harness the energy, the innovation, and the excellence and the talent to solve these problems? They're not difficult. It just requires patience and time and understanding. And I think one of the things that we pride ourselves with the Small Business Administration, and in particular with our partnering agencies across 11 federal agencies who participate in the Small Business Innovation Research Grant and Contract Program, is the notion that we can tap into the small businesses to be a catalyst for change and a catalyst for applying and commercializing, but more importantly, solving these unmet needs and unmet problems with real technological solutions that can be sustainably developed over time through this high-risk, high-reward value proposition of the government incentivization. It's that important policy programmatic framework plays of cajoling in a manner to address, you know, issues like Zika and Ebola and invasive species and whatnot. So there's a lot that can be done, but I think we've done quite an amount, and it's just more about getting that cultural vision together to move forward.
You know, I think one of the great things about a room like this is there are so many smart people tackling the problem from so many different angles. But I think one of the things that you said when you invited us to come and you said in your opening remarks, we are not invasive species experts. What we're good at doing, and I think what and Wendy has some great examples of how she did this with Ebola and Zika, but what we're good at doing is bringing those out of discipline expertise to bear. And I think taking the solutions that might be one or two disciplines removed and bringing them to help solve this problem. You know, when we were talking about, you know, what are the big challenges in tackling invasive species, we talked about early detection and rapid response. Well, there are a lot of other fields, health being one of them, identifying asteroids being another one of them, for which early detection and rapid response are exactly what what the people who are solving those problems are looking at. Well, these open innovation approaches, these rapid scale approaches, can take the solutions that are found in those other areas and bring them to bear here on invasive species. I think that's the conversation that will be interesting to have, both on this panel and as you go forward through the rest of the day.
Wendy. Great, so at USAID in global health, we have a long history of investing in global health R&D and a lot of innovations that we are scaling today and that are saving lives. But we realized, looking at some of the problems, we had a lot of these long entrenched problems where we didn't have solutions. And to Alex's credit, when he was at USAID, he really pushed the whole agency to think differently and how can we be much more catalytic and look for those big game changers. And so we brought this idea of grand challenges into the agency and look to see if we can come up with new ways to solve some of these long entrenched problems. And so we actually launched the agency's first grand challenge around maternal and neonatal health. And it's a great approach to be able to say, all right, well, we can tell you what the problem is, but we don't want to define the solution. We really want to be able to open it up to the world, you know, to engineers and entrepreneurs and scientists and students from all over the world, and come up with new ideas on how to solve these problems. And these grand challenges have been really important for us as an agency to kind of open up the door to completely new set of solutions and new sets of solvers. And we've, in health, we've since applied them, as I already mentioned here, to Ebola, and then most recently to Zika and future threats. And I'll just mention a few quick ideas and insights that have come from that. And one is that it's really, this approach has proven that good ideas can come from anyone and anywhere. And it's not just about going to the kind of traditional solvers to solve these problems, but we've had Argentinian car mechanic come up with the first innovation for obstructed labor in decades. You know, it's a part of this is about how to harness those ideas and create a pathway for those ideas to get seen. But we've also learned that how you ask for solutions is really important. And it is very easy to say, all right, we need these kinds of solutions to certain problems. And that closes off the door to all kinds of creative thinking. So finding ways to ask for solutions is important. And then the other is just creating that space to look for game changers. It's very easy to look for those incremental solutions. That's the easier low-risk option. But finding game changers is really important. So those are some critical insights that have helped us see the value of open innovation. And now we can talk some more about it, but really even kind of pushing the boundaries further to how to use these tools even more effectively.
Lydia.
Hi, my name is Lydia McClure. The Innovation Corps, the iCorps program, has two basic meaty aspects to it. One is helping researchers, scientists, engineers figure out if they have an invention or do they have an innovation. So is there something behind a market need, a societal need, that makes it an innovation versus an invention? So there's a grant program available to guide faculty, students, any technologists really, down their path of customer discovery is what we call it. So don't read market research reports. Go out and talk to the people and figure out, will they buy it? Will they use it? What's the ecosystem to influence whether or not what they're working on is sustainable and scalable and sometimes commercializable? So that's one aspect of iCorps. And the other one is ecosystem. So we invest into startup innovation incubators is what we call them, but they're not biological incubators, they're idea incubators, and support those. So we have about 70, well, maybe 75 universities right now creating a national network. So if there's a team, for instance, we had a team come through from A&M that was working on behavioral studies of birds. And do they have a commercial application for it? Well, they needed to ask a lot of people, and they traveled around the U.S. going through our network to figure that out. We had another example out of Georgia that was doing artificial coral reefs, figuring out who and where should these be implemented. Well, they can't just ask people in their own ecosystem. It's biased. They'll get biased answers. Most people will say yes because they like them. So they had to travel to places where they didn't know anyone, and that's where the network really comes in handy. So that's iCorps, and I think the main reason I'm here to talk through it is because I did hear a lot this morning about ideas, research. Lots has been done, but will that be implemented? Now, there are easy ways that we can, as a nation, teach how to figure out if there's an application for what everybody is working on. It just takes a lot of effort that's very different, gets people out of their comfort zones to talk to strangers. Stranger danger. but it really will make the change, and you can go one by one through faculties or through labs, but you can also go ecosystem and change culture change. That's what we really do with universities is culture change.
Hi, so Lydia, let me pick up on that and we'll start some discussions. What really makes for a healthy ecosystem? And let me ask you a second one as a backup. what are the elements of good design? Because that whole customer interview process is part of design. So it's not enough to have a technological solution, but it's really understanding demand for that solution. What are the processes, if you could address those two elements?
Sure, I'll start with the ecosystem question. There are many diagnostic tools that have been created to find out where you have holes in your innovation ecosystem. Some of them are free. I think Kauffman Foundation has the most recent one that was on. But you can go and figure out for yourselves if you actually have an ecosystem for innovation, or if you're missing a key stakeholder or a key aspect. And a lot of it has to do with mentorship. Do you have people who have done it before, meaning someone who has successfully translated research outside? Are they in your ecosystem, and how many touch points do they make? Do they interact daily with people? Do they interact weekly, monthly? Are they asking for financial incentive to engage in your ecosystem, or are they volunteering their time? The other aspects are finance. Is it government? Is it nonprofit? Is it actual consumers? So where is this money coming from? So there are a lot of different types of ecosystems, and I wouldn't say there is a right type of ecosystem. So everyone has a different one. But if you're missing a key link, we have seen some cities go down in terms of being able to inspire innovation and complete it because they're missing a key link. Is that answering your question? There are many other aspects of an ecosystem that makes it successful for innovation. And at the National Science Foundation, we even do it internally. What are we missing in order to inspire and create innovation? So we do it internally, quarterly, basically.
And Wendy, let me pick up on that. So you have been, you know, you seem to have only taken on really small problems, right? Ebola, Zika, maternal child health, and saving lives at birth. What have you learned through that process? Prizes and challenges, but also mass collaboration. And what have you learned in terms of creating an ecosystem for actually bringing innovators to help you solve those problems along with the government?
We've learned a lot, great thing. So, I mean, one of the things is we've learned the value of some of these tools and the value of experimenting. And so the grand challenge model has been a great one where we've been able to really push the boundaries, get new ideas, get new players to the table. But it's a tool, and it is not right for every problem. And we've also got we've started experimenting with hackathons, where in some cases you kind of need to bring those unlike minds together. And we think a lot of the times, you know, some of these problems, you really need different people with different types of expertise coming together to solve a problem. And sometimes that actually needs to be curated.
Curation mean exactly?
So I think in this case, in the way we've used hackathons, I'll be really concrete. So in case of Ebola, one of the problems we saw during the heart of the outbreak was these healthcare workers had these suits that were really not well made for these hot West African climates. And they couldn't wear them for more than 45 minutes before risking heat exhaustion. They would get in them, they'd start pouring with sweat. Their goggles would give very limited visibility. They'd fog up before you get to your first patient. And then you'd had to go through this long, laborious process of taking these suits off. And that was where the risk of contamination can occur. So problem identified. And so we jumped in and said, well, hey, clearly, we should be able to innovate a solution for this, and stepped in, and we thought, all right, well, let's look at doing a grand challenge. We could have just done a prize, but we actually started to see there were a whole host of other challenges healthcare workers were facing. So we decided to run a grand challenge. But we also said, well, let's actually run a hackathon. Let's try to actually problem solve around this suit. And so pulled together a whole host of different creative thinkers from engineers, we brought in the big suit companies, we brought in people that were good at cooling technologies, we brought in the maker community, the people that are good at tinkering with things on the weekends, and we brought in, most importantly, experts in the field. So we had a lot of different thinkers together, And we learned about the problem. We said, all right, we can broke it down. Here's what we have now. Here's how you get in the suit. Here's how you get out of the suit. And you had the experts really walking through. So you had that user experience. And then we were able to pull these unlike minds together and get them to start problem solving, come up with new designs. And they were drawing. And the second day, people were cutting and hacking away at kind of coming up with new ideas. But that process was a really valuable one to try to, you know, come up with, you know, different approaches to a problem. And what we actually ended up investing in two different suits, but one of which actually came out of a hackathon that Johns Hopkins University ran, and they even had a wedding dress designer with them in their group of players who knew a thing or two about how to get in and out of complicated gear. And so, I mean, that's the idea. These hackathons, you're kind of bringing, you're curating a process by bringing people together and really thinking about how can you approach this in new ways. And so that approach has been, I think, a really interesting one. Sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. I've seen, you know, one of the linchpins to those is really about having people who are users and people who really understand the problem, who are there to be able to provide guidance and real-time feedback. But we're also experimenting with co-creation, which is a little bit like a hackathon, but when you sort of bring people with different ideas together and say, okay, you've got a piece of an idea, and you've got a piece of an idea, and you've got a piece of an idea, how can we think about taking all of these things? Do they work together in some way, and can we take it to a completely new level? So part of all of this is I think, a way of really saying we've got opportunities to continue to experiment around how we innovate and around how we think about solving these problems. And that's where we're starting to see the magic happen. And we're start also learning about what tools work best when.
Wendy, thank you. Chris, I love your idea that there are these other examples that you know, for early detection and response, right? And I think terrorism is another area, infectious disease. The asteroid one is great. And you have advocated for this portfolio response to innovation, even though you've been a champion in this role for prizes and challenges. Could you talk about that and what that means?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my own personal background is in prizes and challenges, so that's where my subject matter expertise comes in. But I think to expand on what Wendy was just talking about, I think it's super important to understand that there are so many different things, approaches and tools and innovation methodologies and programmatic methodologies and all of this stuff that it takes to solve a big problem like this. I think fundamentally what you have done so well, Wendy and others in this space is, and you said it, but I wanna put a fine point on it, defining the problem without defining the solution. I think in all of the things that we're talking about here, that's the critical approach that we've taken. And there's a lot of different methodologies. You can issue a prize and get a bunch of different solvers to compete against one another to win that prize and to solve that problem. You can have a hackathon where you bring all those people into a room together and work on it collaboratively. You can issue a number of different grants to different people who are all potential solvers of that. There are a number of different tools that you can use, but defining the problem without defining the solution is how you get those out-of-discipline experts to come in and solve the problem. Because if you just say, oh, what we need is a widget that will do X, that's an RFP. I mean, if you know that that will solve your problem, issue that RFP, give someone a contract, and go build a million of those widgets. But I think the reason why we're all in this room today and the reason why we've all come to the rooms like this over time is that we know that we have a problem or a set of problems, but we don't know what the solution is. And in most cases, there isn't a solution. So let me go back to asteroids really quickly. NASA recognized, I mean, 65 million years ago, dinosaurs were destroyed by an asteroid, all right? We recognize that we are now smarter than the dinosaurs. We are capable of solving that problem. But there isn't one solution to that problem. So NASA issued an asteroid grand challenge and did a number of different things to address, again, early detection, rapid response. Asteroids are basically just invasive space objects, right? they gave grants to astronomers who are working on the problem. They issued contracts to build new technologies, but they also took this open innovation approach, and they issued a challenge. And out of that challenge, the winner created a piece of software that is now being used by citizen astronomers all around the world to identify, they're called near-Earth objects, so that you have that early detection. And with all of those other tools, those grants, those small business innovation research portfolio of companies that can address the rapid response. So that's how you take a portfolio approach to this, using all of these different tools that we in government, nonprofit sector, the private sector have at their disposal to define, to solve a well-defined problem.
And you bring up the private sector, which I think is really great that we have the Small Business Administration here. And Nagesh, you work in, the SBA works on a variety of approaches to support innovation, from the SBIR program to supporting incubators and accelerators. And you yourself have been an entrepreneur that have come in and out of government. So I was wondering if you could talk about the importance of connecting to economic opportunity, and how does government push and prod the levers to support private sector opportunity?
Sure, absolutely. And this has been a fascinating dialogue. And one of the things that we have to bear in mind is that we're in a capitalistic society. I mean, that's the one thing that we have to bear in mind when we map all this out, is that America is a capitalistic republic. And the economy, the global economy, tends to steer towards that direction. Now, you know, whatever your philosophy or thoughts are on that, different story, but that's the reality is that even though we talk about this notion of double, triple bottom line and conservation being part of that double, triple bottom line, you know, if you look at the thread, the common baseline for double, triple bottom line is still profit. money is the system that we work off of. And so that's where we have to, from the government perspective, is think through the economics and think through how do we incentivize that culture to say, look, just because you're helping do good for the planet and helping do good for society, you can still make money, and it balances that approach out. And so I think one of the things that the U.S. Small Business Administration wants to pride itself on is that entrepreneurs can be that solution. Entrepreneurs can go and be part of that equation of solving these problems with innovators and technologists and actually monetizing and making a market play for responsible economics and responsible environmental plays. If you think of a great example, I would say, of an SBIR-funded company that has done some magnificent work when it comes to conservation and environmental stewardship is Ecovative Design. This is a small business company funded by the SBIR program through grants and contracts from the Environmental Protection Administration, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and National Science Foundation. They were founded by two undergraduate students at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. And well, really what it was is that you had this one guy, Eben Bayer, who is the son of a maple farmer, and they were part of Launch, but I actually used to work for them too, so it's that small world. Eben was the son of a maple farmer from Vermont, and Gavin was the son of a metallurgist from New York City. And these two guys met in a product design innovation class at RPI. And, you know, Eben just got on this notion of like, you know, what if we were to make petrol-based plastics a thing of the past? And he got on this kick of trying to figure out what he could do with mushrooms. And he saw the mycelium tissue that's used in mushrooms have this unique bonding property when growing off the trees and grass and whatnot. And he was like, you know, that's a binding reagent. How do I experiment with this and make something useful out of this? And so that's where in their design innovation course, he came up with this composite material that looks, feels, and acts like a styrofoam material, but is 100% biodegradable and totally compostable. And what happened was is that as he built this technology out in his course and he was all done, the professor, Bert Sorzy, bless his soul, he passed away about a year ago, so he's a wonderful guy. And I was a student of RPI too, so that's how I knew those guys. I was a few years ahead of them, but Bert grabbed the two and said, look, you're innovators, you're entrepreneurs. Don't go, like, I think Gavin was gonna work for a defense company and Evan was gonna go take a job elsewhere. And Bert convinced him, he said, don't do it, start a company. You can make money off this, but you can also do good and change the course of how we look at plastics and biomaterials and look at this responsible conservation effect from a, you know, small business play. And what was funny was is that the guys were like, yeah, maybe. And then Bert said, look, I'll put my own money into you. So he, you know, took his own money out of his own pocket, invested in the two guys. Two guys started applying for business plan competitions and SBIR funding, won a few awards. They started realizing that they had something in play and were technologically validating their premise of a biodegradable, equally, on par composite material to styrofoam. And their first customer was Steelcase. Steelcase said, this is, not Steelcase, sorry, Sealed Air, because Sealed Air is a mass manufacturer of, you know, the styrofoam peanuts and the plastics and whatnot. And they said, hey, this would be a nice new product line offering for our company. We should think about this. Their other first customer was Dell Computers. The servers that Dell sells, they're packaged in these styrofoam blocks. And Ecovative said, look, we can produce something that's on economic par, but is responsible environmentally. And, you know, for the customers, that was cool too, because they all of a sudden got, you know, their servers, computer equipment, whatever it may be. But that styrofoam material, I'm sure many of us have faced it when we got the styrofoam peanuts, we're like, what the hell do I do with this? You can throw it in your backyard and it becomes mulch. That's what that does. It's 100% friendly. And so it comes to that notion of how do we get these entrepreneurs to start thinking a little bit more differently? And that's where the government plays that role, is incentivizing and cajoling with our various programs and policy levers. How do we encourage and incentivize folks to be a bit more responsible with respect to the technology development, with respect to technology deployment? And going back to a little bit of our earlier dialogue on the innovation ecosystems, you know, when you look at the Ecovative design example, the elements that made that work really well was strong university, strong desire from the students to do well at that university. There was a business sector in upstate New York. There is a angel investment, venture capital. So let's break this down into forms of capital. You had intellectual capital, you had social, political capital, you had that support structure there for the students to take that risk, that high risk. You know, instead of, you know, forgetting a 9-to-5 job, they're working for pennies on this notion of maybe they'll create this product or not create it. And you've got that, you know, with that social capital, that mentorship network of folks who were there to say, we wish to champion and be champion, to help you champion this forward. And so you have to look at it from that perspective too. The things that drive people to do what they do, when you think about it from this perspective, is love, pride, money, fear. So if we're gonna really start solving these invasive species challenge and look to technology and innovations to help do that, you gotta figure out on those levers of love, pride, money, fear. And I think in this case, it's really gonna be driven around a lot about love and pride. If you look at the people who wish to come up with those solutions, it's gonna be through that love and pride play. But the catalyst that gets it to be commercializable, gets the big markets to play into it and actually sees that technology and have it be part of their product line offering, that's the money play. That's, you know, when someone sees a cost, you know, when a company like Dell says, okay, I can still go with my styrofoam or I can go with this 100% biodegradable material. It's economically on par. Why not? I'll be an environmental steward, I'll look good, and it's not gonna cost me anything more.
Absolutely. I wanna open it up to questions from the audience. So are there any questions that people have that they wanna ask? Right here, please.
So for invasive species,
just wait one sec for the mic.
So for invasive species control, I think a lot of the opportunity that exists is with genetic biocontrol. So I'm interested in knowing what are your thoughts about trying to develop entrepreneurship for that particular type of application?
So from the SBIR, SDTR perspective, that's already occurring. You've already seen topics of funding interest from the governments like USDA, EPA, and a National Science Foundation. They've put topic proposals that do delve into that area of interest. And do I think, that's going to be a very controversial thing because that goes into the genetic modified organism world, basically. And so let's look at the reality of it is that Monsanto is here to stay. Monsanto's not going anywhere. And so, you know, we're crazy to think that we can, you know, disregard that science or disregard that the potentials of the innovations that come out of that. I think what it really comes down to is how do we be smart about it and how do we be informed about it so that we make the right decisions so that it does not impact people in an adverse way that we are starting to see in some scenarios.
I think you bring up a great point, which is how do we, which I think you've raised, which is how do we think about risk? And what we fail to realize is sometimes doing the same thing, practicing the same programs may be the greater risk overall as we weigh things.
Right.
But Lydia, I want to ask you to answer that question. What are your thoughts on how do we help with this, particularly around the genetic space?
Sure. There's a lot of deal killers, right? If you have a top three deal killer to making something succeed, and it is genetically modified organisms and opportunities are not well taken by society and are not approved, then that is a deal killer to that line of innovation going forward. That's not currently where we are at. So that's not a deal killer. So we should still continue to support that kind of innovation because some of them will succeed. And the way you can help someone decide how far they're going to go on that opportunity is to give them an opportunity to learn about who we call them saboteurs or influencers are in their ecosystem. The influencers can be negative and positive. That's where the saboteur comes from. But to know who they are, know a timeline of that person or that industry or that government agency's power and indication and create a de-risked portfolio of ideas. So if something does happen in 2 years that derails the business model that was originally proposed, then there is a second option. So nothing is a surprise. So there is a logical scientific method to help people go through what is a business model. And once you know how to do the scientific method for business, then nothing is impossible. So that's the idea of customer discovery and going on innovation. It's just the same as science. You just have to continuously think of all the risks and have backup plans, is another way of saying it.
Well, what I'm thinking is, what if you had an individual who has the expertise to make a genetically modified python, for example? Well, they invest in that, and there's no regulatory framework to allow them to actually sell that product. So how do you solve that problem?
And one of the things that I'd add to this is, so first of all, for any of the innovations we're talking about, whether you know, genetically modified or otherwise, the strategy to scale is often far more important than the innovation itself. And so you do have to think through all of those different issues. And we know for a lot of these different approaches, the regulatory pathway is really important. And to really bring to market, you're going to have to be able to find ways to actually make it through that regulatory pathway. You need to actually understand, and we talked a little bit about it, the end market and who's going to buy it and are the communities going to accept it. So we've seen a lot of this actually as Zika. And we've invested in things from Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes, which really are not genetically modified. We've seen that we've got genetically modified mosquitoes already out there on the market, and they're facing challenges with just community acceptance. They're facing some regulatory challenges that they didn't anticipate. We've seen lots of ideas on gene drive, which are even much further upstream, where they will have even more issues around regulatory path and any ethical issues. But for all of these, you really need to kind of think through all of the challenges along the way and not underestimate them. So even in the case of Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes, which I think are revolutionary, and we've been investing in them to bring Wolbachia-infected mosquitoes that's actually blocks transmission of disease. A lot of evidence behind it over the last 10 years, taking it to try to scale it up in a city the size of Medellin. Well, one of the things they have to do is they have to just build community acceptance. So you're actually releasing good mosquitoes into a community that right now is fearing mosquitoes. And so they spent an entire year on community education and just getting people comfortable. They're working with schools to help have schools, and this is brings in citizen science. So children are actually the ones releasing mosquitoes in their own communities. But had to really work very hard with local officials, with community activists to really help build that buy-in. You see the group that's got genetically modified mosquitoes, they're trying to get it into Key West. They don't have the community behind them. They face real resistance. So, and they're facing regulatory challenges. So all of that, maybe you're in the room. all of those pieces are really important to try to think through. And sometimes you're double tracking or triple tracking and trying to move your innovation forward while thinking through these other pieces and getting your regulatory pathways in place. But ultimately they become big barriers to scale if you don't work through them.
Chris, did you have a quick comment?
No, I think we should take some more.
One, please.
I want to add to the whole discussion. In thinking how to create this genetically modified organisms, one pathway will be the pet industry. Because it's not human consumption, you could create a genetically modified organism for pet distribution. Once you develop the tool, then the commercialization will be for any agency or anybody that wants to use it. Currently, there is no limitations to it. As I said, as long as it's not, the FDA is the one regulating it, and as long as it's not consumed by humans or has interaction with humans, it's pretty hard not to be able to permit it. And there is no regulation for any fish in the pet trade. So, or for that matter, pythons. You can create a genetically modified python for a color that doesn't exist in nature, patented, and you already have the tool to commercialize the Cas9 python to agencies.
Yes, this is more of a comment, okay? I'm one of these researchers in the trenches. I've gotten SBIR, STTR on previous projects, gone all the way to commercialization, right? So I've got some ideas to control what David Lodge was spending a lot of time on, zebra mussels and quagga mussels. And I've spoken to people at SBIR, at NSF, and of course you need to have some preliminary data. You're not just going to hand out write checks. And that's what I want to emphasize here, that it's extremely difficult. I've got two ideas, okay? It's extremely difficult to raise the seed money to get up to that step. And of course, it's not public health. You know, this morning I've heard of all these successes. Yeah, public health is put at a higher level than conservation. You know, David Lodge may say accurately that each household in North America has $200. That's what they pay. But they don't know about it. And frankly, they care more about their health than $200. So it's a real disadvantage when you work on invasive species and they're just conservation problems or ecological services.
That's a great point. And I think, just out of curiosity, besides National Science Foundation, have you looked at agencies like U.S. Department of Agriculture and EPA?
Well, you know, EPA, I received $1 million grant from EPA for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative in 2010. But now, and I bet you it's because pressure on them. They're only funding shovel-ready projects. It's the opposite end of the spectrum of me with these ideas for eradicating zebra mussels in North America. I'm not just talking about a pond.
So I would, the one thing I would just emphasize is that this is where it becomes important for you with your voices to raise awareness.
Because, that's why I'm here.
No, absolutely, but not to me, because you're preaching to the choir. It's to the folks on the Hill, the Capitol, the folks who actually control what the budgets will play out and dole out that money.
I just want to say I've never done that. As a researcher, I've never approached politicians for support or.
But that's what I'm trying to tell you is that in order to raise that awareness, in order for them to provide that funding up, that budget line for us to then be able to do that, for USDA to have increased funding to fund this kind of projects, which I think are very important, that's where we need the help. You know, talk to the people at the House Small Business Committee, talk to the people at the Senate Small Business Committee, talk to the people at the House Committee on Science and Technology. You know, let your elected officials know, because when they start to realize that this is an important issue that needs to be addressed, they will then say, okay, we need to really think about what these appropriations will be so that we can start funding these areas that need to be incentivized because the private market's not doing enough.
So let me take this in a slightly different direction and address maybe some of the institutional, both the government and university and other institutional folks in the room. And again, trying to learn from other sectors here. It sounds like we've clearly got a problem. That's the whole purpose of today's event. It sounds like there are some nascent technologies and solutions that are out there, but they don't have the data to support that seed investing. There's maybe a question about how best to apply that technology to solve these different problems. Sounds like institutions could offer some prizes to address well-defined problems and give these different innovators a chance in an open, transparent, competitive environment to solve those problems in a way that creates the data, proves that they work, provides some seed funding, and gives the validation for further investment and ultimately scaling. Really quickly, lesson from another sector, energy. Wave energy conversion has a lot of potential, but is a really nascent technology. 50% of the world's population lives within 60 kilometers of the shore, I think it is. So if you can figure out how to get energy out of waves, you can power a huge percentage of the world's population. You can do it cleanly, you can do it, all these things. Nascent technology. The U.S. Department of Energy decided that instead of offering a bunch of grants to potential different technologies that would work, they'd offer a prize. Well, they just awarded the $1.5 million wave energy prize to a team of two innovators from Portland, Oregon, working out of a garage, basically, who the prize was to double the state of the art of the technology in 18 months. The winning team had a fivefold improvement in the state of the art of the technology in 18 months. And the top four teams all doubled it. And they proved that it works. And now they have data. Now they can go out and get that follow-on funding and bring it to scale in a lot of different ways. So I would say, from the person who's, you know, advocating for different approaches to innovation, I think if I were an institution in this room that was looking at solving the problem, it sounds like I've got a problem, I've got a clear gap, and I've got some researchers and technologists that are ready to jump in to help me solve that problem. And an open innovation challenge might be a good way of starting to approach that.
How do we actually ensure that the sets of solutions we have match the speed and the scale of the problems we're taking on? And if we are not doing that, there's really a need and a desire to harness this portfolio of innovations, reconsider how we actually achieve that. I think second is recognizing that there is a demand and a need for having an open door for innovation, whether it is prizes and challenges, other innovation funds, you know, harnessing things like the SBIR program. But it's also not going to be necessarily the government that is going to be solving this or academia that's going to be solving this, but it's how we actually build that larger innovation ecosystem. And that really requires understanding the problem and doing the taking that scientific approach to whether we're understanding these problems and whether your innovation is actually the right one. We may have what we think are brilliant ideas, but what the nature of the problem actually requires something else. And that takes evidence for us to be able to address. Please thank this great panel and enjoy lunch.
Thank you. Thank you.